Well, I think today I can say without fear of contradiction that QCD is our most perfect theory of nature. And what could be more and what could be more perfect than to squeeze a lot of it into a very small space? Well, it turns out that the state of matter you get by doing that doesn't disappoint. That's what I'm going to talk about today. So, at high density in QCD, as we'll see, one can combine the methods of asymptotic freedom and BCS theory, two beautiful creations of ITP directors, to describe a situation that very likely actually occurs in nature, that is, in the center of neutron stars. Here's what happens. I'm sorry. Let me first explain the approximations I'm making, since some of them are a little unusual. I'm working in 3 plus 1 dimensions. just for the heck of it. Just because it's easier somehow. I'm going to take the number of colors equal to 3. And I'm going to take the degree of symmetry, supersymmetry, to be 0. In addition, for this first page, I'm going to be analyzing what happens, as I said, at high density, what happens when you squeeze matter to high density, or equivalently high chemical potential for baryon number, at 0 temperature. And to make the symmetries manifest and make the theory more perfect, I'm going to, for this first page, although it won't be the real world then, I'm going to, for this first page, put UD and S quark mass is equal to 0, and CB and T quark mass is equal to infinity. Okay? So then we get the theory I call QCD light with 3 flavors. This is a theory that has no mass scales at all, no parameters at all, no continuous parameters whatsoever, and yet is a remarkably close description of nature. So here's what happens at high density to qualitatively change or qualitatively determine what the nature of the state is, and in particular how it differs in its symmetry and its properties from the naive no particle ground state and from the classical symmetries of QCD. By analyzing the force between quarks at large momentum transfers, because we're working at high density, we have large momentum transfers, we know what the form of the interaction is microscopically, thanks to David, we find that there's an attractive force between quarks on opposite sides of a Fermi surface. I should say, first of all, I'm using the Jesuit strategy of asking forgiveness, not permission. So what I'm doing here is assuming that we can start with quarks and gluons and weak coupling, see if we get a consistent picture, and then if we do, we'll have succeeded. That was the strategy we followed all those many years ago. It worked pretty well, time and again. Okay, so starting with the quarks and gluons and the microscopic interaction, assumed weak because this is a large mass scale, this chemical potential, we find that there's an attractive interaction between quarks. It's not like electrons where the microscopic interaction is Coulomb repulsion. The primary interaction is Coulomb repulsion. And to get superconductivity, you need a quite sophisticated analysis with phonons and retardation. And in any case, the superconducting temperatures are quite low. Here, the primary interaction is already attractive. And you can identify quite precisely the channels in which it's attractive. Basically, two quarks can either be in a triplet, an anti-triplet or a sextet state, and it's the anti-triplet which reduces the color, which gives an attractive force. Since that's anti-symmetric, it's not something that you would see in a one-charge theory like QED. But in QCD, you can identify exactly what Cooper pairs form, what channel is attractive, and minimize the energy. So there's no guesswork here. You're actually minimizing the legitimate energy given the Jesuit stratagem. And what you find is that you do get a form of superconductivity with structure, because we have all different kinds of colors and flavors as well as spin and momenta involved here. And we have to keep track of all of them to find out the nature of the Cooper molecules and what physics they induce. And what they induce and what happens is the following. The overwhelmingly favored ordering, which again you can compute based on the microscopic interactions with no additional hypotheses, is that the spin indices pair off so as to make a rotationally invariant state. Also, the momenta are the only momentum dependence is on the absolute value of the momentum. And here we have color and flavor indices. And what you find is that the colors and the flavors lock together. This is a similar behavior to what one finds in the B phase of helium-3 superfluids, where orbital angular momentum and nuclear angular momentum lock together. And only a rotation of both simultaneously is a good symmetry, whereas in the ordinary state, rotation of them separately is very nearly a symmetry. Okay, so what happens here is that color locks to flavor. In the ground state, ordering develops, correlations develop between color and flavor indices. So these Kronecker deltas here have one index which is a color index and one index which is a flavor index. This means that color symmetry and flavor symmetry separately are broken, but a combination of them, the diagonal combination where you rotate both together, remains a valid symmetry. Thus, the naive symmetry of QCD are not so naive. I've already taken out the ones that are violated by quantum mechanics, the anomalous ones. The symmetries of QCD, the color cross the of QCD light, I should say, color cross left cross right symmetry cross U1 baryon number, are broken down to just the diagonal SU3 symmetry, an SU3 flavor symmetry. There's an interesting detail in that the condensates form separately among the left and right hand in components. This reflects the underlying chiral nature of the microscopic interactions which are responsible for the condensation. But because both of them get locked to color, and color is a vector symmetry, the only residual symmetry is a vector flavor symmetry. So chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken by this new mechanism. Also, my transparency is off. Oh, here we go. You find that there are gaps, mass gaps. It takes a finite amount of energy to produce any colored particle, any of the gluons or any of the quarks. So this is a form of confinement. There are no long-range gauge forces left, and there's a mass gap, whereas the original theory did not have a mass gap. The other feature of the spectrum is that there are Nambu-Goldstone bosons associated with the spontaneous breaking of chiral symmetry. And also a superfluid mode, superfluid, not superconducting mode because it's neutral, associated with the spontaneous breaking of baryon number. That's just superfluidity in the same sense as helium-4. Okay, so altogether, this spectrum, which you can calculate from the microscopic theory, in a completely controlled weak coupling but non-perturbative calculation following BCS methods, looks remarkably like the spectrum you would have guessed based on phenomenology and conventional wisdom and experiment in this version of QCD. Furthermore, the existence of the gluons get a gap, they look like vector mesons, the quarks get a gap, they have the quantum numbers of baryons. The difference between one quark and three quarks, which you normally think is a big difference, because baryons should have three quarks and quarks should only have one quark, is negotiable here because diquarks are floating all through space. Okay. Furthermore, if you turn on electromagnetism, then there's another interesting part of the story. This condensate also breaks naive electromagnetic gauge invariants because, for instance, it pairs U quarks to D quarks with appropriate colors. There's no reason why A couldn't be 1 and B couldn't be 2 for U quarks and D quarks. All kinds of different kinds of quarks are getting paired with each other with appropriate colors. And so electromagnetic gauge symmetry is broken. However, just as in the standard model where hypercharge is broken, yet a clever combination of weak isospin and hypercharge survives and becomes electromagnetism in the true vacuum, here a clever combination of the original electromagnetic gauge invariants and one of the broken color generators is unbroken, and that becomes the photon in this state. Another aspect of confinement and the match with phenomenology here is that with respect to that photon, all the elementary excitations, the quarks or baryons, the gluons or vector mesons, and the pseudoscalar mesons are integrally charged. And they would have just the same charges as you would calculate, say, in the BAG model. Okay, so that's, I think, a very nice state of matter. But we're not talking, I haven't yet been talking about the real world. So, to talk about the real world, we have to see how this beautiful state is modified or perhaps destroyed by turning on non-zero quark masses. The quark masses definitely look dangerous at first because the essence of the Cooper instability, the essence of the thing that triggers superconductivity, is pairing between particles of opposite momenta near the Fermi surface. And if you're trying to pair quarks with different masses at equal energy, they have different size Fermi surfaces, and therefore you don't get a Cooper singularity. You don't get zero energy states by taking low energy excitations around those Fermi surfaces of equal and opposite momenta. But you might think that, again, appealing to the Jesuit stratagem, just pretend that the masses didn't matter and then see if you can get away with it. If you form a gap, then the Fermi surface is kind of fuzzed out. You've pulled in things from the Fermi surface. And if that obliterates the difference that the masses would have made, then it doesn't matter. You can put the masses back in and the superconductivity will remain robust. And that turns out to be the case. The precise mathematical criterion is that, let's say we just turn on Ms, because that's the dominant effect, Ms squared over twice the chemical potential has to be less than twice the gap. This is what you gain by breaking a pair involving a strange quark and turning it into just non-strange quarks. This is what you lose in interaction energy, because you have to break a pair. And if you lose more than you gain, you don't do it. And if you put in parameters that are realistic for neutron stars, this is satisfied. The other effect of non-zero quark masses is to lift the masses of the Nambu-Goldstone bosons from zero, all except the superfluid mode. But the superfluid mode is electrically neutral, and so the accurate statement is that non-zero quark masses, and the important statement physically, is that the non-zero quark mass lifts lifts the masslessness of the Nambu-Goldstone modes of chiral symmetry breaking, or to put it another way, it means there's a gap not only for charged excitations but also for colored excitations, but also for electromagnetically charged excitations. Or to put it yet another way, it means this stuff is an insulator. The world's best insulator, because the gap is quite large, much larger than any other condensed matter system known to man. Tens of MeV. Okay. One interesting aspect of this is that the spectrum of Nambu-Goldstone bosons is inverted. It turns out that instead of the pi mesons being the lightest, the K mesons are the lightest. The way you can think of this is that to get something with the quantum numbers of a pi meson, U d bar, using diquarks, I have to use the diquarks that are dual to these, namely U has the same quantum numbers as d bar s bar, and d bar has the same quantum numbers of us. So this thing really, something with these quantum numbers, really has two strange quarks hidden in it. And that's what comes out of the mathematical analysis too. So numerically you find you can estimate the mass of the K mesons is something in the order where the lowest energy excitation in the quantum of any charged channel is something that has the quantum numbers of the K minus, and it has an energy of 5 to 20 MeV. So potentially here we have something, I think, that does justice to the title I gave, the most perfect state of matter. You squeeze very hard, you have a lot of QCD in a small space, and what does it produce for you? Not some ugly thing that you can't analyze, but something that's clear and transparent, not just theoretically but literally, and something that if you shine light on it, since electromagnetism is modified but not destroyed, some of it will reflect back, some of it will get through. In other words, it'll look like a big diamond. The diamond as big as the Ritz, actually much bigger, and also 10 to the 15th times denser. However, I used to say that, but I realized it was a joke. There seemed to be a big fly in the ointment which would prevent actual realization of such a thing. That is, another effect, apparently, of turning on the strange quark mass is the following. Suppose you neglected the interactions altogether to begin with. Okay, so you just had free quarks. And you had only a chemical potential for baryon number. You had the condition that the weak interactions enforce in the long run of chemical equilibrium. Then in the free quark theory, the proper condition would be that you impose equal Fermi energies on all three quarks. But since the Fermi energies depend on momentum squared plus mass squared, the net result, and numbers of states is count in just momentum squared, the net result is that you'd have fewer strange quarks than the others. And so the ground state, although the excitations have a gap, well, there's a gap to producing charged excitations, the ground state itself is charged. Of course, that's unacceptable, and what it means is that this state would, in reality, have to have some electrons in to compensate the charge. And the electrons make it much less beautiful. The electrons ruin the diamond and make it just into a dull metal. And also make it not pure QCD. Okay. In view of the time, I won't go through these little calculations to show that if you use hadronic matter, there's a large density of electrons. That's common knowledge about neutron stars. And if you use quark matter with sort of reasonable parameters for the interior of neutron stars, you find that there's much less in the way of electrons, but still more than enough to make it a dirty metal. Okay. So now I'd like to tell you the new result that's just emerged in the last couple of months, which is that in reality, there are no electrons in there. The ground state is electrically neutral. You can actually understand this on the basis of a simple heuristic argument. Of course, energy is king, ultimately, and that's the argument I gave you before. You've tried to, if you had free quarks to minimize the energy, you'd have unequal numbers of UD and S quarks. But we're not dealing with free quarks. We're dealing with quarks that want to pair and that have significant interaction energy. And the pairing is most efficient if it's between Fermi surfaces with equal limiting momenta. You want to have P and minus P pairing up near the Fermi surface. So those are the zero energy excitations near the Fermi surface. So energy, therefore, to get the best interaction energy, to get the most out of this attraction, appoints momentum regent. That's the only way to get the vanishing energy denominators with a good density of states near the Fermi surface. But this has the simple and profound consequence that since you count states in momentum space, if you have equal Fermi momenta for up, down, and strange quarks, that means you have equal numbers of up, down, and strange quarks. So the real thing really is electrically neutral with no electrons. It really is a transparent insulator. It really is the diamond as big as the Ritz. Well, you can also show this by formal arguments and calculations, just to show you that I can do calculations, but I can't explain them. Okay, we should still ask if maybe, we still need to want to apply this to reality, and in particular we want to ask, how does this perfect CFL phase interface with hadronic matter, with what you normally think of as what's inside a neutron star, that has, as I've said, quite a few electrons. In fact, the Fermi energy of electrons in the interior of neutron stars is of order 100 or 150 MeV. So, could it be that this, so that those electrons sort of infect the CFL phase because of the pressure from the outside? Or how do we model this kind of situation? Can we hope to construct a simple canonical model of the interior of a neutron star based on the one hand on solid hadronic physics, on the other on our asymptotic, even more solid, knowledge of QCD. Okay, so let's think about what would happen if we set up this situation dynamically. We have too many electrons on this side, so they start to slurp over. Okay, if their energy is 100 MeV over here, they're heavier than the K mesons. So they decay into K minus and neutrinos. So eventually you'll have a flow of negative charge over here, positive charge gets left behind, and you form what condensed matter physicists call an inversion layer. So it's like we have not only the diamond inside, but also the world's biggest diode. Or transistor component, I don't know, whatever. You can set up equations for this. Very simply, there's electrical energy connected with the different stuff. There's the Fermi ball energies. And for the K mesons, there's this kind of energy that you learn about in Bose-Einstein condensates, or Higgs theories of the energy of the condensation. And then you just minimize. Does something sensible emerge? Well, hot off the presses. Yes, it does, and it very nicely confirms the heuristic that you might have guessed from the dynamical hand waving I was doing before. Electrons start to slurp over. You get a K condensate over here from the electrons that have decayed, and the protons go up in density over here because they're attracted to the negative charged K mesons. So you can make quite a nice, sensible picture of it and compute surface tension and maybe do some physics. Yeah. A couple more. Oh, Tony just informed me that unfortunately I don't have time to tell you how to test these ideas. And so I'm going to stop at this point and maybe take a question or two. Yes.
How do you test these ideas?
You test these ideas by waiting 30 years or so for a supernova. Well, the serious answer is that we will test these ideas by making detailed models of neutron stars and seeing what the characteristic behaviors are that are different between this kind of model and other kind of models. Let me tell you one that at present we only know about in cartoon form, but could very well be a very characteristic kind of thing. Okay. In this talk, I talked exclusively about the situation that we call weak equilibrium, what happens after a very long time. And in particular, I let the neutrinos freely escape. During the early moments of the collapse of a massive star, the supernova event, neutrinos can't escape, or they escape very slowly compared to times we can observe and dynamical timescales of the star. So you have a different kind of condition then with lepton number also being conserved. Okay, and if you have this collapse situation, electrons will be dragged along in the initial collapse together with the baryons, and so you'll have a non-zero lepton number which then gets trapped. Okay. Now in the CFL phase, the hadrons are electrically neutral, as we've said. So the way to accommodate leptons is just to have neutrinos. So you start accumulating a lot of neutrinos until the neutrinos Fermi surface gets really high, and then the neutrinos can decay into electrons and K pluses. Okay, I'm not finished yet. I'm getting to the punchline. Okay, so you have these electrons and K pluses when you have the neutrinos trapped, when the neutrinos can't escape. Now, suppose, and this is where it's oversimplified, well, it's already oversimplified because I've ignored temperature, but let's just suppose that suddenly we went from the condition where the neutrino, so where you're totally opaque to neutrinos, to the condition where neutrinos can escape. Okay? Then this configuration with lots of K plus mesons is radically unstable. The K plus mesons immediately decay into electrons and neutrinos. And so you get like a laser pulse of neutrinos coming out, all with monochromatic from the decay of this K condensate. Okay? So that discussion is oversimplified in many respects, but I wouldn't be shocked at all if some observable remnant of that laser flash comes out of the analysis. But many other things might come out too. I'm finished with the answer to that. Well, I'm not finished with the experimental signatures, but that'll do. Yeah.
Yes. Question. In your very initial modeling,
yes.
Life thought are massless.
Yes.
You have no dimensional.
Right.
What's the critical mu?
What's the critical mu?
Yes.
The critical mu.
For the people in the back.
Zero infinity or?
No, no. Okay, the question was, in QCD light with no mass parameters at all, apparently, what sets the scale for the critical mu? But, you know, as David taught us in ancient days, well, in recent days when he was still, when he was young, and of course he still is young, so therefore it wasn't very long ago, really. As David taught us, and we've learned, QCD light does have a mass scale. Okay? It doesn't matter for QCD light itself. You can trade the coupling for the coupling, which appears to be a parameter, for the mass scale. And so, instead of having an infinite number of theories with different couplings, you just have different theories which differ only in their unit of weight. Kilograms, pounds, and so on. In any case, there's a dynamical mass scale, and in real-world QCD, that's roughly 200 MeV. And so this critical potential will be something like 200 MeV for quarks. We don't know it exactly, though.
That, Tom Banks?
Yes.
I didn't understand why, in the context of your approximations, you don't get a second superfluid component from the U1 axial.
The U1 axial.
You're not seeing the effects that break that in these perturbative.
No, that's correct. I mean, so there could be an additional pseudoscalar neutral boson which is almost massless. That's broken by the residual anomaly effects. No, I mean that
would be incredibly small to the extent that you're approximating.
Yeah, it's incredibly small. So there's sort of two forms of superfluidity.
Okay.
Yeah, we're aware, it doesn't, yeah, if I had longer, I would have talked about that.
There's a question from our local expert on neutron stars.
Uh-huh.
is it robust that the color flame, that your CFL state is denser than your hadron plus electron at the same pressure, since at that boundary it needs to be if you want it inside of the hadron state?
Well, I think it is, but I don't. Since we don't know what the critical potential is, we don't really know.
But I guess what I'm saying is, across that boundary you've constructed, the pressure needs to be continuous.
Oh, yes, it is. It is.
So the question is, what's the density on either side? There's a density jump associated with that, I presume.
Yes, there will be.
Does it have the right sign?
I think it does, but I don't. We haven't checked it. Overall, I mean, it does. If you dissociate hadrons into quarks, it tends to be possible to squeeze them much harder together. So I would certainly I would be not only embarrassed but stunned if the quark matter weren't a lot denser than the hadron matter.
No other questions? Then we'll go on to the next speaker. Thank you.